Hello and welcome to the Evie Forums podcast for Bank Holiday Monday, the 1st of May. And joining me on this edition are Assistant Editor Steve Withers.
They got my dick message.
News Editor Mark Hodgkinson.
Asleep for the danger, awake for the money, as per frickin' usual.
Audio Reviewer Ed Selly.
I am not some starry-eyed waif here to succumb to your pelvic sorcery.
And special guest star Mark Boatwright.
Who?
Right, so this week's podcast, well, after successfully covering politics last week and annoying people, I think we should go out of our way this week and let's start with a discussion on religion in all its forms. Mark, have you bought a Switch?
I might have done.
Knew that was going to happen.
You know what was crushing was the fact that when I told you, there wasn't even a hint of surprise about it. And I
The only surprise was that it took as long as it did.
Yeah.
I know, I lasted about 6 weeks, which is
impressive. Because there was no stock.
Yeah. You know, if one human year is 7 dog years, to me, holding off on buying a new Nintendo console, that's like an eternity.
Yeah. I know, I am impressed that you went as long as you did, but I am afraid that, yes, my levels of surprise, it was like, in other news, water is wet and bears may or may not defecate in woods.
I don't have any games at the moment.
It's nice to look at.
No, so I'm playing a demo of Tetris.
Well worth the money.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a sound investment. Sound.
Well, no, as long as you're crossed, happy.
No, fingers crossed. My copy of Zelda should be showing up soon. I think in the end, it was the portable aspect of it that kind of sold me on it. The idea that...
I think it's the fact it was a Nintendo.
No, that's a coincidence. yeah, I'm not even going to go into my reasons. I think we all knew that I was going to cave at some point.
How far have you got on the Wii U version of Zelda, Mark?
Not very far. That's why I ended up buying it, was because I just thought it's one of those games that's going to be a real kind of time sink, and I want to be able to kind of play it in comfort.
Waste your time in the best possible resolution.
Yes. Yes, that should be the tagline for the Switch. No, I thus far, impressions are good. They're pretty much everything that Hodge covered the other week. You know, it's a slick bit of kit, but, you know, say at the moment, perhaps a little bit wasted just with a demo of Tetris. But, you know, I shall pick up games. Don't worry.
Right, let's move on. Current competitions. Tell us all about Hodge.
Current competitions. You can win a copy of Why Him on Blu-ray. And this competition closes on the 12th of May and is open to all eligible members resident in the UK, Ireland and the Isle of Man.
And previous competition winners?
Yes, we do. We have a forum regular, I think he's a podcast listener as well, a Roustafarian, who won the UHD Blu-ray box set. And we've got what's also SparkItUs69, won Swiss Army Man on Blu-ray, and number 6, I am not a number, won Bleed for This on Blu-ray.
Look at that. Previous winners and everything.
And everything. And I've heard of one of them.
It's almost like we're organised because it's the end of the month, eh?
Yeah.
That's when things happen, isn't it, Ed?
Well, yeah. Well, no, can I stress that for many of my contractors, exciting things happen from me at different points in the month. You, as befits the working relationship I have with AV Forums, done on a monthly basis, you get stuff by the end of the month. That's kind of how it works.
And you literally mean the end of the month.
Yes, yeah. All right. It is telling that I have to go in when I actually remember to put the things on the big board of management that we use online. And it's like I have to alter the due date to absolute end of the month at 23:59. Otherwise, it just totals out at midday, and that's just not enough time.
Well, the challenge is keeping to the same products that you said you're going to do at the start of the month by the end of the month, isn't it?
There is an element of that, but if we're honest,
it's
we're
hot luck sometimes.
We're all at the mercy of sometimes distributors and manufacturers are simply unlucky. We've all had it, so we thought it was going to be here by this time. It's not here. You know, we just don't have them to send. Other times, I occasionally work with some smaller and more invigoratingly sort of odd companies. That's like actually
unorganized.
We're not sure. Are we going to? We're not sure about getting a review at this point, so we've decided not to send it. It's like, oh, okay.
These sound like excuses to me.
Well,
like you're one step away from changing your deadline time zones.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought about
it. You see, you're giving him ideas now, Mark. He hadn't even thought of that one.
It's unfortunately this month we'll be going to the wire, but there's a fair amount of copy in the bag, and I will be continuing once this enjoyable podcast recording has ended. I have to change the laundry as well, put it in the tumble dryer.
Right, Ed, did you buy any records on Record Store Day?
Yes, I did, Phil. I mean, that's about as surprising as...
Well, hang on. Let me rephrase that. Did you leave the house, go out and go to a record store and buy records?
Yes, I did. And what's more, I took my son with me. Although I did wait until he was really...
Brainwashing.
I waited until he was really groggy and confused, so he was easy to manage. I wandered down there. I looked through the list. There were a number of records that I'd have quite liked that. But allowing for the fact that, you know, I don't have an unlimited budget, and a large number of items would disappear at unbelievable o'clock in the morning when the hardcore fraternity who'd been queuing went and bought it. There were a couple of things I'd sort of earmarked. I went down to Black Circle Records in Leighton Buzzard, who helped me with some of the questions in the piece I did for Record Store Day. And they had a copy of the first album by an American band called Midlake, which had never been put on vinyl until this Record Store Day, and I bought a copy of that. They didn't have another record, which I have been looking for. So if anyone is listening to this and then in the very small Venn diagram crossover that also have frequents record stores that participated in Record Store Day, if anyone is able to find the 12-inch single of God Song by Toy Drum, it's a remix by a bloke called Frank something, and it's got a sort of like splatter cover. If anyone picks up a copy of that, I will sort out PayPal payment and you can get it over to me, because at the moment it's not cropping up very much on Discogs. I would like a copy of that. So
lots of complaints said that Record Store Day, now in its 10th year, it's kind of gone against what it was set up to do, which was to make vinyl available. Lots of complaints that it's now used as a marketing exercise by record labels, and that there's lots of people who basically go in, buy the records, and within 5 minutes they're on eBay at six times the price.
Yep, that's entirely, and the criticisms are entirely justified. The thing is, though, that these are, you know, it's the same situation that means that incredibly scarce gig tickets can be found online at heartbreaking markups and so on and so forth. It's the nature of the beast. The only thing I would say, over and above the same problems that affect like Glastonbury and gigs and so on and so forth, is at the very least these people had to drag their asses out of bed, queue overnight to buy the damn things. I'm sure that in a couple of locations there might be a bit of under-counter work going on, but I don't think there's a significant amount of it. Your chances of getting the things are still pretty legitimate if you're prepared to just be a bit odd about it. The other argument, of course, as I say, is that Toy Drum record that I was talking about there were no copies ordered by the record shop that I went to. So it doesn't really matter what time I'd have got there. They weren't there. I mean, most record shops are not in a position to order all 400 titles. So the only way I've got of getting that record, realistically, is for someone to sell it on to me. So I can't criticise it on one hand and then make use of that mechanics on the other. That's the nature of the beast. I do think that this could be avoided by perhaps celebrating new music more than, you know, just releasing yet more weird back catalogue bits of, you know, Bowie and Floyd and all the rest of it. I think it would be more fun to celebrate new artists a bit more, but you know, there has to be, this isn't being done as a charitable exercise. Everyone obviously needs to make some money out of it too.
Well, I noticed there was one band, don't ask me what the name of the band is, I couldn't tell you what any bands are nowadays, Jesus, but one of the bands noticed that this was happening with their release, which was limited to so many copies, and noticed that they were going straight onto eBay. They've told their fans to hold tight because they're going to release as many as needed to make sure everybody gets a copy
at the standard price. No, that's very admirable, and I think that I have to say is an interesting and useful thing. I mean, obviously, one of the more impressive bits about Records Today, and I alluded to this in the piece, and it did happen again this year, is that as well as the stuff on the list, there is an incredibly tiny number of things. Just essentially, record stores will make their order and they'll occasionally just receive something which they didn't pay for, and it's dropped in. And that these are like the equivalent of, you know, golden ticket sort of Easter egg items. And yeah, that happened again this year. And a couple of years ago, there were bits and bobs from a group I'm a huge fan of called Boards of Canada. And I would have, you know, done terrible things.
Again, another group that probably only you know about, Ed.
I don't know. Boards of Canada, it's yes, it's not top of the pops for them, but it's...
I sometimes suspect you're making these up. It's like, well, like a script from Nathan Barley or something. They don't exist.
What, you mean like in Brass Eye when he's doing all the made-up drugs?
Yeah.
Well, I assure you, Boards of Canada are real. If Phil is feeling enthusiastic, he could perhaps put a Boards of Canada album cover as this podcast starter point.
I don't know about that. I think we need to start talking about modern things now. So let's go to Steve. Samsung Q8 TV. It's the new QLED, which the more I see this, that they're doing this on purpose, so it looks like OLED. That has to be the case, Steve.
Maybe, maybe not.
Your silence speaks volumes. I'll take that as a yes.
Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Got to change the batteries on the mic.
Yeah, and you could have done this hours before we started?
Could have done, didn't.
Okay, so while Steve sorts his batteries out, let's go to Mark. Mark, your game of the month, please.
Oh, lots of stuff. Stuff that actually I haven't been able to get a hold of, actually, so I don't know whether I can consider it game of the month, but I've been very pleased to see that Persona 5 has been out of stock. When I say pleased in the sense that it's selling well. Kind of long-running Japanese RPG series on the PlayStation 4 and the PS3. But my game of the month, even though it's a month that has also a Puyo Puyo Tetris on the Switch, is the Silver Case on the PlayStation 4. Kind of a quite an obscure old adventure-style visual novel type game. And I was massively surprised to see that it gets a physical release. You know, this is kind of almost in... like Ed's territory of seeing an old record that suddenly becomes available again. You know, this, if you haven't gone down the digital path and you want to be able to keep titles for posterity, then this is very much a great find. From more of a kind of auteur figure, Suda51, who's absolutely mad as a bag of badgers, but we've had Flower Sun Rain on the DS, and this works very much as a title that links into that, as well as, if anyone remembers, Killer 7 on the GameCube. Overall quality is probably not going to be for everyone, not the greatest game of the month, considering the quality. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe coming out on the Switch, which is, you know, kind of contains all the DLC and extra stuff with battle mode for that game, which really kind of completes it as a package. And the aforementioned Persona 5, which seems to have got rave reviews, but just for kind of a piece of nostalgia and for almost kind of filling in, if you've been interested in these type of games and you want to kind of scratch that itch and just see what it was that started off this kind of overall style that Suda51 had of madness, then yeah, it's very, very good and worth picking up.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm sure everybody out there who plays games will be interested in that if they haven't already played it. And let's move to Mark, the other Mark. Channel 4 is launching personalised adverts with audio. Tell us about this one. This seems a bit Minority Report, that's the one.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about it, really. I think it's a bit creepy to me. But yeah, Channel 4 announced this week that their VOD service for all four will start running ads which will call you out by name. So you have to register to use all four, I think, to put your email address. They've got 15 million registered viewers on their database and the likes of Foster's Lager. And who else have they got? Heineken.
Ron Seal,
which I think which I find absolutely fascinating that how they're going to use it. They've got 20th Century Fox on.
Sorry, I wondered if Ron Seal might do a little bit like the Coke thing about your name on the tin.
Yeah, you know, you're probably right. You probably nailed it there, Mark. You probably got some guys shouting your name to tell you to sting
your
face.
The Fox advert to be one for Alien and go like, Mark, there's an alien behind you.
Yeah, it could. I mean, it could be quite effective. I mean, I guess there's nothing more sort of to get your attention than actually hearing your name coming out of the telly. I think it's only going to be your first name. I don't think they're going to be using surnames. That'd be a bit too advanced. But yeah, they're going to try and grab people's attention by shouting at you through
the telly.
That
would be a shame, Mark, because I was thinking of signing on to All Four as Gert Tosser. And seeing
well, I was just
sign on as Tosser.
I was just going to say, you know, if it's taking the first name and the email address, there's going to be some,
I'm sure I've registered for this service, but I can't remember what the details.
And under what name did you register?
Strozzi McBoogables.
It would have been some years ago when I
the Hodge.
So it'd be quite interesting to see how that plays out. It's all this targeted smart TV kind of interaction. There'd be a lot more of this stuff coming, no doubt. I think Google are launching adverts now where you can just click through and buy straight away, so instantly. It's all heading in that direction to sort of break down that barrier between the advertisers and you. Yeah, it's evil. It's an evil progression, and I don't really like the idea of it. But I'm sure we'll see much more of it.
At the very least, I think I only use it through Sky. So unless Sky has sold my details to them, I think I get to escape this for the immediate future.
I think you can be fairly confident they have had.
Well, they almost certainly have,
and everybody else too.
Yeah. You know, the sad thing is though, it's just going to be fuel that I get targeted with. I'll be sharing that soon.
Come on, Phil.
You'll be getting direct adverts from OPEC.
To be honest, I can't wait.
Buy the shit, UHD Blu-ray.
I can't wait until this makes it further down the television dial to places like Eurosport. Because obviously Eurosport does advertising on a pan-European basis. And it has the strangest companies advertising. I mean, some time ago there was an advert for the Panama Canal. I mean, I don't know quite how that influences
use it more regularly.
Yes, completely. But I want that to be targeted in my name. Ed, look, we've got extra capacity and new lock systems on the Panama Canal.
It would have to be that, because I don't think any vinyl companies that have got the budgets these days to advertise, have they?
There's the people that do the, you know, the Time Life, this is not available in any stores. They spotted a gap in the market and are now.
Just imagine they actually just ring up Ed directly, then just ring you up and say, "Do you want to buy this album, Ed?"
They don't need to. As I say, unfortunately, a couple of forums that I frequent and Discogs is enough to ensure that I could spend every cent I have, remortgage the house and more, and I'd still have records I wanted to buy. So, you know, they're fine. They don't need to advertise.
At least your records on the structural at the minute.
Not yet. Although, as my wife pointed out, the toy fire engines probably are. Yeah, that's going to be problems with those.
Right, while we're talking about vinyl, what are the big releases this month that you really like in terms of playlist, album of the month, and your vinyl release?
Right, okay. The album of the month, absolutely logically, is the new Gorillaz album called Humans with a Z. Considering that they have been at this on and off, not consistently, for 19 years, I think the whole point of any Gorillaz album is that you don't love every single track, because they do lots of different things. They push in different directions. I've only given it a sort of cursory listen so far, but I just admire the fact that they're not, you know, playing it safe. It's not a comfort zone record. They're still doing interesting and exciting things. So that is unquestionably my album of the month. I think it offers the most things to the most people listening to this podcast, whatever your actual genre of choice might happen to be. Playlists. I thought I'd give Apple Music some love this month, so I was having a look through there. I stress I didn't install iTunes on my computer. I'm not that mental. I was looking at my iPad. Obviously, Phil and I, for some time, used to enjoy a playlist that was on Tidal called Blips and Blops, but that sort of died a death. The good news is that Apple Music has sort of kicked one into being. They have a series of playlists called the A-List, which then go through various categories. The electronic category section of the A-List is a damn good listen if you happen to be an Apple Music listener. If you don't, you can probably look at it on an iDevice and then just sort of make crib notes and copy it across to another streaming service of your choice if the fancy takes you. So that would be my choice for playlist.
I've got to say, Ed, I've always been Tidal when it comes to you know, streaming and so on. But yeah. When I updated my Vodafone contract, I got Spotify Pro free for a year, whatever they call the paid service. And to my delight, when I plugged my iPhone into the Mustang, I have access to the complete Spotify thing account on my touchscreen, which is fantastic. Yeah. I never knew you could do that. So I've actually been using it quite a bit, and I've got to say their algorithm for Discover Weekly and your Daily Mix,
it's uncanny.
Unbelievably good. I mean, all the tracks on there are like, you know me. It's scary how much it knows me.
Just do you know what's even more staggering? It still works even if the only thing you listen to in a week is that Discover Weekly playlist, because it will study the amount of time that you listen to the actual tracks on the playlist. It will look, if you click through to the artist and had a look at their other content, and still build an algorithm from that. It's one of the most sophisticated pieces of software being used anywhere in our industry. It's a really, at some points it's quite uncanny, but it's genuinely clever, and it's cost me a bloody fortune, if I'm honest. So
I've got to say, you know, it's not as high quality obviously as Tidal, which is you know, the lossless stuff
in the car though,
but in the car it doesn't matter at all. And I've got to say, I'm using Spotify more than I use Tidal, and I used to listen to Tidal in the car quite a bit, and I've got to say the quality, there's no difference in the quality there through your mobile anyway. So
with 90 odd dB of exhaust and engine noise in the background, yes, I don't think the difference between 320k and lossless is going to be significant, if I'm honest.
It's not that bad, Ed. If you're just cruising around, the exhaust's really, there's no drone there. It's really quite quiet. It's only when you've got a heavy right foot.
Fair enough. I'll take your word for it. Right, and so I'll finish off my vinyl release of the month. This one's a little bit more out there. And I'm sure that it will get Mr. Botwright's false band name siren sounding. It's an album called Cascades, and it's by a pianist called Jean-Michel Blais, B-L-A-I-S, and an electronic artist called C-F-C-F. It's 30 minutes long, and it's essentially augmented piano music. It's modern, I suppose, for the want of a better description, it's modern classical. Just give it a listen. I have to say, it's one of the most beautifully balanced and judged sort of 30-minute sections of music I've listened to in a very, very long time, and I am falling over myself to get hold of my vinyl copy of it, because without going into unnecessary detail, I know the mechanics of who's mastered and pressed this one, so I know it's going to be a good pressing, and it doesn't overstay its welcome at 30 minutes. It's absolutely fantastic.
Okay, good stuff, Ed. Thanks very much for that. Thanks to Mark as well for his roundup of the game of the month. Now we'll move over and see if the prima donna's ready. Are you ready, Steve?
I am, yes.
Right, okay. So you've been looking at the Samsung, like I said, QLED. The more I see this name, the more it annoys me, because it's pretty obvious that it's made to look like the word OLED. And it's really not necessary.
I've got to say, if you look at the side of the box, the lettering really is designed to look exactly like the OLED logos on the sides of LG boxes. So it is a little bit disingenuous, I suppose, is the word. Now, we've talked about this at length on previous podcasts, the fact that basically what we're talking about here is an LCD panel with an LED backlight and quantum dot film over the LEDs, which gives it a brighter, more saturated colours, which is all well and good, but that's not exactly new. I mean, this stuff's been around now for some time. Really, having now tested one of these TVs, to me, because in all fairness to Samsung, last year's KS range was pretty ahead of the game. It was pushing the envelope as far as what TVs could do already.
I absolutely love the one that I've got sitting here. For an LED TV, I would probably spend more money on one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the KS range was superb. And the problem is that the problem they made for themselves was that, you know, moving on from that this year has been a bit tricky. I mean, they've obviously tried to position it in a certain way. And I think their pricing this year for the QLED range is way over the top. I mean, it's far too pricey. I think they're going to struggle to sell out those kind of numbers. But, I mean, the one I reviewed, which is a 65-inch Q8C, the C means it's curved. There's an F at the end, it's flat. There's a C at the end, it's curved. The Q8 range only comes in a curved model, actually. That's £3,799. That's a lot of dough for an LCD panel in this day and age. Having tested it, really, it's an iteration. It's an evolution of last year's KS range. So they've taken the basic design and they've improved on it slightly. So for starters, the Q8 is all metal construction. Now, I think you can vouch for this, Phil, last year's. They used a lot of plastic in it, and the construction wasn't necessarily as good as it could have been. I know I've heard reports of some production problems.
Well, the back comes away. The back's coming away on the 9500, which I've been using here for tests and that kind of thing. It's unfortunate, because if you had spent that type of money, I think you're quite right to feel a bit annoyed.
Yeah, so the Q8, all metal construction, lovely, beautiful construction, really well made, lovely finish, brushed metal rear panel. They've the same kind of stand, but instead of being sort of rectangular bar, it's actually kind of a tubular bar now, but it's basically the same principle with a flying V support at the back that gives the impression that the TV's floating in midair. So that's very nice. Remote control, it's the same remote control in terms of the controls and layout, but it's again had a makeover. It's got a brushed metal finish as well, all metal construction. It's very comfortable to hold in the hand. Really like that. Unlike the A1 Sony, you know, you feel like you've got a high-end remote to go with your high-end TV, so that's good. The smart platform was basically the same as last year. It's a Tizen-powered platform. There's been some tweaks here and there, and it's got the same launcher bar at the bottom where you can access all of the content you want to watch. So again, that works really well. It's responsive. It's robust. It's got pretty much everything you'd want in there. So that's good. In terms of the picture performance, like I say, last year's KS was really good. So they've tried to push it as much as they can, but they were already on about 95, 96% of DCI-P3. Now they're at 99%. You know, it's got a... I measured it at 74% of Rec 2020, which for a TV is the highest I've measured so far to date. They made a big thing about the fact they've got the wider color gamut. They've also made a big thing about peak brightness. Now, this was interesting because I measured the peak brightness in dynamic mode at 1,700 nits, but in the accurate calibrated modes, it's about 1,250. Still very bright, but not as bright, I have to say, as the XC93, the Sony I reviewed a couple of weeks ago. That was hitting 1,500 nits, even in a calibrated mode. So that was really bright. So it's still bright, but not as bright as the competition in a calibrated mode. Obviously, Samsung can say they've got really bright over 1,500 nit TVs, but not necessarily in an accurate mode. In terms of its performance with SDR content, really good. Nice, accurate picture. They've introduced some extra controls in the menu system in terms of calibration. They've got a 20-point white balance control. Now, they've also got an auto cal feature that works really well on the grayscale and the gamma. Not so good on the color gamma because it basically gets a really accurate 100%, but then the 25, 50, and 75 are all over the shop. So that bit I wouldn't bother using. I would just set the either auto or manually calibrate it in the custom color space mode. But the auto cal, the grayscale, and the gamma is really good. That worked really well. And you can set tolerances as low as 0.5. In fact, I think it defaults to 0.5 delta E, so you can get a really accurate grayscale and gamma using that. And it takes the laborious aspects out of going through a 20-point. So it's got all these new calibration controls. It got a nice, accurate picture in terms of grayscale and color and gamma. And then and with SDR content, as I say, it looked really good. Local dimming works really well, as long as you're sat centered to the screen. I mean, they made a big deal this year about them having wider viewing angles, but it's still a VA panel. As soon as you move off axis, you're going to start seeing contrast and color dropping off. It may be better than last year, and it's better than many other TVs that I've seen so far, but you still do suffer from that. So bear that in mind. Your haloing won't be visible when you're central, but it will be visible when you move off to the side. Where it struggles, and this is something I don't think we see how they can get around this, the LEDs are along the bottom of the panel. And where it struggles is with HDR content, because with HDR content, you've got the local dimming set to high. You can putting out 1,250 nits of peak brightness. You're going to get bright bottoms, and sometimes you get sort of when objects are moving around and say a bright object against a dark background, you're going to get some haloing. You're going to get your black bars may not be as black as you'd like them to be. And I really don't see how they could get around that problem using a TV where the LEDs are at the bottom. It's different if it's a direct LED backlight. The only way to get around that is it's what Sony did with their XC93, and what I believe Samsung are going to be doing something similar with the Q9, which is Sony are using two layers of LEDs on either side of the screen and what they call their backlight guide plate, which basically means they can break the screen up into four sections and have much greater control in terms of local dimming. And that works. That worked really well. You still had a bit of haloing and stuff like that with the XC93, but it was definitely better than the Q8C. And this is where Samsung are going to struggle, because you can get the XC93 for £600 less. And you're getting most of the same things. The build quality is excellent on that TV. You've got the speech. Hasn't got quite as wide a color gamut, but it is, as I mentioned earlier, slightly brighter. I'm not a massive fan of the Android platform on Sony, but and the remote control's a bit crap. But otherwise, you know, £600 is £600. And so I think at the current price points, the Q8 and the whole QLED range are going to struggle. I mean, it was a great TV. It's certainly worthy of a recommended badge. But with HDR content, it can struggle sometimes depending on the content. And I think it's overpriced.
I'll play bot right. What the input lag?
Input lag, 24 milliseconds. That's whether it's a 1080p, 4K, SDR, or HDR. So that's great. If you're a gamer, really good TV for that.
Does that remote control get cold? It looks like it'd be cold. The NVIDIA Shield remote gets freezing cold when you're not using it for a while.
It can feel a bit cold on a cold day, yeah, because it is all metal. It's one of those things.
First world problems.
Yeah, you wear gloves. Some mittens.
It might be quite nice for summer, though, if I was hot.
We ask the questions no one else will dare to.
I quite like it. I'm really cold.
I've got to say, Steve, you know, let's not knock Samsung. They make some absolutely fantastic products. But this QLED line is just, it's just a bit strange, and I don't understand the market. Well, I do understand the marketing. Like you say, it's a bit disingenuous. And the fact that the pricing as well, it's, and I can't see what they're adding that would add that much to the price. And I don't think Brexit is an excuse either.
No, I mean, the pricing, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. Because in the past, Samsung have been very strong in two areas. They've produced high-quality TVs at competitive prices. And they seem to have suddenly sort of gone for the high-end market with a high-end price. But with the best world in the world, this is still an LED LCD television. Yes, it's got things like quantum dot. Yes, it can go quite bright. And yes, it's got a wide color gamma. But you're competing up against TVs that are costing less, that are performing just as well, or maybe costing a bit more, but are bringing more to the table in terms of, you know, okay, you're going to pay $5,000 for the A1, but it's an OLED TV with an acoustic surface, you know, instead of a speaker. It's got lots of bells and whistles in there that make it quite unique. £3,799. I mean, you're looking at, you know, if you go on to the when you wait for the Q9 to come along, that's going to be $5,000. That's going to be the same price as the A1. I think they've overpriced this. I think if it was cheaper, I think they sell a lot more. But at current prices, I think they're going to struggle against the competition right now.
I think the pricing is sort of OLED led, as it were, so to put themselves, you know, say, well, whether we are in this bracket, this TV is of that OLED quality. Do you think the price has got anything to do with that?
It's possible. It's possible. I mean, what would be interesting to see how the range below, so that's the, I think it's the MU range, which basically would be a sort of equivalent to last year's KS, to see how they perform and how they're priced. Because it might well be that, you know, you can get almost as good performance for a lot less money if you just go down a range and not bother with the whole QLED thing.
That's pretty much always been the case with Samsung, isn't it? The 6 and 7 series have always been the sweet spot for me, anyway.
But it was interesting to sort of measure the peak brightness, because they have been making a big... I mean, Samsung and their marketing have been making a big thing about color volume. A big thing about... They've been calling it HDR 1500. It can do 1,500 nits. And I know that some early reviews of the Q7 weren't delivering those kind of numbers. I mean, this did deliver over 1,500 nits, but as I say, not in an accurate mode. Color volume measurement was the biggest I've measured on any TV so far. Just pipped the XC93. So basically, XC93 had more brightness, but not as wide a color gamut. The Q8 had a bigger color gamut, but not quite as much brightness. So they ended up being almost exactly the same in terms of color volume. But I think the color volume measurements that Samsung quote, when they say 100%, they're talking about 1,000 nits and DCI P3. But even then, it still wouldn't be exactly 100%, because obviously LCD TVs can't deliver the same kind of color volume accuracy at lower brightness levels that, say, an OLED can. But conversely, an OLED can't do the same thing at the higher end of the scale. So it kind of evens out. But yes, the color volume measurement was big, but only just slightly bigger than the XC93.
Again, this is another confusing thing with the whole marketing thing as well, Steve. You know, they're talking about technologies and being able to do things that the vast majority of TV buyers don't know about and probably don't care about.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the poor old consumer is going to be bombarded with you know, sort of acronyms and statistics this year. I think they're going to hear a lot about color volume from marketing campaigns. Obviously, HDR, you've got HDR Plus, which we were talking about last week, is coming along, which, by the way, the QHC does support out of the box, along with HLG, of course, and HDR10, normal HDR10. You're going to have Dolby Vision being put out there as well. it's going to be and then you've got things like HDMI 2.1 waiting around the corner as well for later in the year. I suspect come EFA time we'll see some TVs with those in them. So it's and then after that HFR, it just goes on and on. So you got to feel sorry for the consumer in a way, because they're going to, yeah, you're right, they probably just want half decent telly at decent price that's going to work, and they're going to get bombarded with all these all this data and acronyms and. Which of course
keeps you with a job though.
I was just going to say at least they can turn to AV forums and we'll cut through all the marketing blurb and tell you what's what. That's why we do what we do. Otherwise there wouldn't be much point of us doing what we do, so we'll cut through all the bullshit and we'll tell you what's what and what's worth buying and what's not worth buying, or what's worth looking at and so on,
and what's got the coldest remote.
Yeah, I think that's important.
I've got to say, I don't know where that one came from. That's
is this pretty, that's 21st, pretty out there. 21st century version of who's got the best feeling control knobs?
Yeah,
because that still matters. Knob feel.
I'll tell you what, this Lingdorf thing that I've got in at the minute. Oh, yeah, that's nice knob feeling. That
that's a ball race. That's not a euphemism, but it's got a multiple bearing assembly, so it's really really smooth.
Oh, something else.
It's like I was talking to a guy who he used to work for a much more well-known manufacturer. All things are relative, and he's building his own ridiculously high-end turntables now, and he makes a tone arm that costs £27,000 but has no friction. It is as measured under scientific conditions. It is frictionless. Essentially, the understanding is it's frictionless within the constraints of the distance it would move. If it had to move a distance of, say, 3 miles, friction would occur, but no friction occurs over the distance that the arm race actually moves.
So on some kind of mercury base or something?
I have not the slightest idea, but for $27,000, you can use some probably quite exotic things.
I'm sure he sells many of those.
I'm astonished he sells any, but it's one of those things. I have, it might be quite nice to listen to it, but I just actually want to feel what that feels like more than anything else.
Yeah, it's more tactile than anything to do with sound quality.
Probably. But that's the nature of the beast, isn't it?
When you're spending 27 tone arm.
So. Yes. So you need to buy
entire deck.
I believe if you tick all the boxes on the biggest record player with this tone arm, with all the attendant options, you will get it's a six figure sum.
Even as a billionaire, I still think.
But this is the thing: there
to play your scratched record on.
Yes, you can play your copy of Agadoo by Black Lace on it. So that's something totally different. But it's more as you say, feel and your points of contact. And it doesn't really matter whether it's a piece of audio equipment, whether it's a television. If it's your car, if you don't get the major points of contact right for the consumer, it sort of doesn't begin to matter how well the product performs as a whole. It's only in recent years that I think people have really come around to accepting just how important this is. So it's good to see in a number of categories people paying attention to it. We might joke about weird remotes, but it does matter. It's your major point of contact to a television.
And somehow we managed to come back to vinyl and record players and tone arms, and yet you have a go at us when we want to talk for 5 minutes about Star Wars.
Yeah. If you only wanted to talk about 5 minutes about Star Wars, that would be absolutely fine. However, I'm at pains to stress that last week's edit made me sound thoroughly unreasonable. And to be fair, I am thoroughly unreasonable. I would like to point out that the original non-director's cut of that Star Wars context was rather longer.
So it's about 25 minutes, and I think I left about 7 minutes in there.
Yes, so there.
But hey, that's the prerogative of the editor at the end of the day. I can make people look really silly, or I can make you look brilliant.
Well, I'm not sure about the latter.
There's a first time for everything, isn't there?
You can't create what isn't there. I'm still amazed by the toilet seats that don't slam.
Yeah, they're good, aren't they?
Right, that's it for hardware. Movie news next. Right, moving on to movie news. We were going to do Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, but Steve's car broke down.
Again,
yeah.
Fortunately or unfortunately?
Well, at the time I was gutted because I was really looking forward to seeing the film. but which was a midnight screening. But at 2:30 this morning, I woke up and went for a wee, and I remember thinking I'd still be in the cinema right now. So actually, I wasn't that bothered at that point. I thought I could always go and see it on Sunday night.
Okay, so
if I get my car fixed.
So for the film of the month.
Well, that would have been a contender, obviously, a late entry. But now, having not seen that yet, my film of the month, obviously, is Fast and Furious 8, which was spectacular fun. I really, really enjoyed it. Even though it's dumb as a box of frogs, it's still really, really good fun. So if you haven't seen it yet, why not?
Interesting that Car Trouble has ensured that a film still notionally about cars has snatched the title from a film not about cars. How peculiar.
Anyway, you know what else? I've just found out I've got a volume control in my headphones. For months, I've been listening to you guys really quietly in these things, thinking that was the whole call recorder, and I've just put my hand on the side, and there's this thing that moves, and it's actually a volume control.
Ladies and gentlemen, the editor of the UK's foremost technology site there.
Discovers a volume control.
Discovers a volume control.
I can hear you all now. I can hear everything that's going on.
So all those times you get tangles, we were too quiet. It wasn't us at all.
Oh, God. Is it warm or cold to the touch?
I kind of believe I'm that stupid.
This is the point where we just diplomatically say nothing.
I kind of believe I just did that. Anyway, the other thing I've just realised is I haven't gone to the cinema this month.
Again.
What a surprise.
Kong wasn't this month, was it?
No. Odeon wins again.
Christ, they got a whole £18 out of me this time.
Yeah.
Ah, you see, they're crafty. They know what they're doing with these unlimited cards. They know that there's idiots like me.
It's not a lot you can do about it, but... Are you planning on going to see Guardians of the Galaxy? Because that would at least partly redress it.
Yes, I'm going to go probably Monday morning to see that.
I mean, obviously, you do know it's a bank holiday, so everyone else has it.
That's why I said Monday morning.
Fair enough.
That's great. I'm able to hear everything that's going on now. Is there anything coming out this Friday at the cinema, Steve?
There is. There's a film called Unlocked, which has a surprisingly big cast, a film I've never even heard of. It stars Naomi Rapace, and it's got Orlando Bloom, John Malkovich, Tony Collette in it, Michael Douglas, even. Basically, it's a thriller set in London where a CIA interpreter has to stop a terrorist attack involving a biological agent.
I've got to say, a lot of those actors and actresses are ones that haven't been around for a while, Steve, even though they are big names.
Anyway, so Unlocked, a thriller about terrorists, which stars people who haven't done much work recently.
Fair enough. Right, so let's move on. It's end of the month, so our Blu-ray of the month. Don't come at me, I haven't seen any.
Yes, you have.
Have I? Oh, yes, I have. Well, yes. Yes, I have. How could I forget that? I watched it again for the fourth time the other night as well. Cinderella.
Well, that's not everything, yeah.
Rogue One. Yeah, okay. So, like we said, like we promised to Ed, we won't talk about it. No Star Wars.
Too much.
Yeah, but fantastic disc, great picture, superb sound. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, I'm with Phil on that one then. My choice would also be Rogue One for the same reason.
And by default, mine would be as well, but it was excellent after the first 20 minutes of acting. What was the baddie called in it? I don't take much note of names. You know, the main...
Director Krennic.
Him, yeah. He wasn't very good, was he?
Ben Mendelsohn, he's in Bloodlines.
I know, he's brilliant in Bloodlines. Bloodlines is Danny, but I thought he was pretty shocking.
Mr. Botwright, what's your Blu-ray of the month?
No, I'm just looking. No, that wasn't out this month. Okay. It was out end of last month. But can I still have that? Does that count?
If you bought it this month.
Yeah, it arrived this month, so that has to count. Lone Wolf and Cub Collection.
If you watched it this month, then you can have it.
Sweet. Okay. Well, obviously. Another great surprise. I'll choose the Lone Wolf and Cub Criterion Collection that finally got a UK release end of March, but I got it this month.
Okay, cool. Blu-ray releases this week, Steve?
Not much. There's just one out, really, which is Why Him, a comedy starring James Franco as a billionaire, internet billionaire, who going out with a guy's daughter and the father of the bride doesn't like him very much, and they sort of lock horns, which is also, as you noticed at the beginning of the podcast, a competition prize.
Doesn't really sound plausible, does it? If he's a billionaire, the father's going to love him.
You'd think so. I've got it on Ultra HD Blu-ray. I haven't watched it yet.
I don't know what to say.
It's full of surprises, this podcast, isn't it?
I really know what to say. A crap film on UHD and you've got it. That's not breaking news anymore, is it?
Well, there'll be some news later in this podcast then about that subject.
So Mark bought a Switch, Steve bought more crappy UHD Blu-rays, and you didn't go to the cinema. And Ed bought more vinyl. So it's
why change it's a habit of a life?
A podcast you can set your watch by.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, so I guess we have to do the Ultra HD Blu-ray of the month, Steve.
I'm going to go for Planet Earth 2.
Snap.
Oh, did you get it?
Yep. I eventually thought, well, that's only 30 quid. That's half a tank of fuel.
That's not bad value, is that, for all you get?
Yeah, it's those snakes, though. Oh. That is the art of editing. If just watch that one scene. If you don't watch anything else in that series, just watch that one scene with the snakes. That's how to edit and have people on the edge of their seat every time they see it. It's just the pacing's right, the timing's bang on. The music's good and it builds tension. I mean, it's made up of unrelated shots. I mean, the way these things are put together, you know, it doesn't all happen at once. It's all stuff that they've been probably shooting that for 4 or 5 days. But the way they just put it all together and add that sense of it's happening now and this is happening now and it's fantastic. That's how you make TV. That's how to make a scene. They should win plenty of awards for that. It's really, really good.
Attenborough's Swan Song is certainly a great way to go.
It was. It was excellent. Well worth getting on UHD Blu-ray as well. It's probably the first title I would say you have to go and buy on UHD Blu-ray. It looks sumptuous. Right, moving on. We're going to have to do Star Wars news. Unfortunately, people, we're going to have to talk about this. What is it, Steve?
With only a short piece of news that you'll be glad to hear, Ed. Just that they've announced and this isn't really big news because I kind of assume this anyway, but they've announced the release date for Episode 9, which is the 24th of May 2019. So basically between now and the next 2 years, between now and 2019, we've got 3 Star Wars films coming out, so that's good news.
Anyone else slightly worried that we might hit saturation point at some point?
Yeah, we will, very quickly, I think. And then we'll be going to have too many Star Wars films. But we'll see. As long as they keep bullying in $1 billion, because they'll keep churning them out, won't they?
Well, I've got to say, I'd much rather have Star Wars films than those stupid bloody comic book and superhero movies. And they make plenty of those every year.
Yeah, oh, and we've been forecasting the end of those for the last 4 years, and they refuse obstinately to die.
But one day we'll be right.
Statistically, I suppose that is the case. But yeah, I've sort of given up now. They're just going to keep going.
We like that man holding up the end is nigh sign. When we finally see that comet coming towards Earth, we can say, I told you.
Right, so anyway, talking about Marvel and all the rest of it, Guardians of the Galaxy, we didn't get to see it this week. I'm going to go and see it, so we can talk about it next week. It's only a week late. People won't notice, Steve. We can easily do that. But anyway, the first film, I've got to say, it did really capture the whole sort of fun sci-fi thing, almost like Star Wars. I wouldn't say it was Star Wars, but almost like that. And it was good buddy, good comedy, slick effects, interesting story, and characters that you related to. And it got me thinking the other day, you know, when we were growing up, Star Wars blew on the scene in 77, and then for a genre which had been ignored for a long time, Steve, in fact going back to probably the Flash Gordon serials, sci-fi had really been ignored. It was B-movie stuff in the 50s, like you say, Flash Gordon, and then there was very little, maybe 2001 in the 60s. But that was like a...
There was plenty of sci-fi around, but it tended to be... It was much more sort of darker-toned, dystopian stuff. So things like Soylent Green or Logan's Run, Planet of the Apes. There was stuff around.
Yeah, but that
kind of derring-do, exciting, Flash Gordon-type thing hadn't been done for a long time, which was one of the reasons why George Lucas got the idea of, you know, doing a Flash Gordon... Originally he wanted to do Flash Gordon, but you couldn't get the rights... doing a Flash Gordon type space adventure.
Yeah, and the thing from my childhood, maybe it's just the way you think when you're growing up and you look back on things with rose-tinted specs and all the rest of it, but there seemed to be a bit of a renaissance, certainly in the late 70s, early 80s, kind of died out again come the 90s, but there was that fun sci-fi thing, and I'm thinking of things like films that I haven't seen since my childhood, like Flight of the Navigator. There was stuff
like... Don't watch
like,
it again.
I'm not going to watch it again. I've got fond memories of it. I'll leave it there back in my childhood.
Exactly that.
There was other stuff like Battlestar Galactica, like the original Battlestar Galactica. It came out as a movie and then obviously as a series. You had Buck Rogers. Again, came out as a movie and then went on to be a series, or was it a series and then made it into a movie? It was one or the other.
Well, they were both TV series, but they cobbled together the first two episodes and the pilot, basically, as released in Europe as movies.
Yeah. What was the other things? The Last Starfighter, fond memories of seeing that, and there's lots of others, and there was lots of stuff that I cannot remember the name of, but it was cheap tat sci-fi that was just released because Star Wars was big. But I've definitely got fond memories. You, Steve?
I have, although it's funny because I was talking about this with a friend, and we was, you know, there's this perceived wisdom that Star Wars comes out and people make lots of knockoff copies of Star Wars, but in actual fact we struggled to think of that many. I mean, there was a renaissance in sci-fi in general, but I think the sort of the derry-do space adventure stuff wasn't actually knocked off as much as we think it was, because, yes, there's Battlestar Galactica, that was a TV series, but that was clearly influenced by Star Wars. Disney did The Black Hole, which was clearly influenced by Star Wars.
Oh, yeah, Black Hole, I'd forgotten about that one. And obviously you got Star Trek was rebooted for the obvious reasons.
Yeah, because of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Although they had been working on that for a long time as a TV series. It was going to be called Star Trek Phase 2, and then obviously when Star Wars hit, it was like, sod it, let's do a film. But actually, there wasn't that many things we could think of that had that kind of the space opera fantasy romp element to it that Star Wars had. It still remained relatively unique. The closest I can think of as a film I loved as a kid, and then watching it again, thought, what the hell was that all about? It was The Black Hole, because clearly Disney were trying to do a Star Wars. They had cute robots, they had lasers and other robots, and Maximilian was the, you know, like a Darth Vader type villain.
I'll tell you, I haven't seen that since I saw it as a kid. Again, I like Flight of the Navigator type thing. I've never gone back to them. I've always left them in that space where, because I think they'd be rubbish if you watched them now.
I'll tell you what, The Black Hole has got one of the most left field endings of any kids movie ever made in history, because they go through the black hole and basically go to heaven and hell. I mean, I remember even as a kid thinking, what the hell is going on now? It's like watching a Star Wars ripoff and then shoving in the end of 2001 suddenly, right at the very end of it. It's just really bizarre.
Yeah, I can't remember any of that. And then obviously not that long, I mean, you'd have been a teenager by the time of the 80s, were you not, Steve? Or were you into your 20s by then?
I'm a teenager.
And then you start getting things like Alien and Aliens and all that kind of thing, and really good sci-fi stuff, Terminator, that kind of thing. But like you say, the soap opera thing, it tended to stay, and it is a soap opera, Star Wars.
I think space opera fits more.
That's what actually Lucas described it as that at the time.
So. Soap opera makes it sound a bit like, you know, Den's giving Angie a divorce papers on the Death Star.
It's going that way, Mark. If we've got a film every year, it's going the way EastEnders, really, isn't it?
They should just have that.
So they should hire Danny Dyer.
Danny Dyer's too big for Star Wars. Ed, can you think of anything from your childhood that wasn't war-related or torpedoes?
It's funny because in film terms, there just isn't that much. It was not a great film, but I did love the portrayal of space and the equipment in the otherwise somewhat unremarkable Titan AE from the turn of the century. It's not a great film, but it's enjoyable to watch, and it was beautiful, and there was the same sense of not everything was minty fresh and brand new, and well, not least because, spoiler alert, Earth had been blown up, so they weren't big on making new stuff. That I enjoyed that. I thought that had
animation is beautiful in that.
Yeah,
it really is. That's old classic animation. It's fantastic, and the sound mix.
Oh, yeah.
I think the sound mix still stands up pretty well today.
So that I always liked how that looked. But then it goes to TV series for me. In terms of an environment as unique and as, if you like, as crafted as Star Wars, I don't know how many other people have watched this. I'm assuming Mr. Botwright would have done. Was, for example, the portrayal of moving between the planets in Cowboy Bebop. I always thought that was beautiful. I always thought that was just fantastic. And again, it was a combination. There was new and shiny stuff, there was old and beaten up stuff, and it just felt so homogenous, so well thought out, so crafted. And another person that managed to do that quite well was what's his chops with Firefly?
Joss Whedon.
Yeah, that's the one. I prefer what's his chops. Which obviously, I suppose, as a cheat, comes with Serenity, which also managed to achieve some of the same stuff.
Yeah. Oh, it's Firefly.
yeah, those are the, it's funny because films just seem to, if in doubt, they go Star Trek, and for the most part, that spacecraft, space stations, all the equipment they use just has a sort of minty freshness, and it's all clean and new and works as it's supposed to, and just doesn't have that lived in feel to it. It's like life is a laboratory in space, and most sort of portrayals of it don't move too far away from that. Ironically, Alien, the Nostromo is more lived in than the environments in Aliens and there on afterwards. They feel in some ways more sterile, more unnatural.
But it was a mining vessel, though.
Well, I thought it was just a sort of cargo hauling job, but same difference, I agree. But other than obviously with a number of these things, the presence of gigantic CRT screens, I mean, unless humanity suddenly decides that flat screens are causing some sort of horrendous illness, they date the sort of spaces that they're in. But otherwise, the Nostromo set, it looks quite convincing other than all the water.
Don't you love that, though? The old kind of like monochromatic screens and that kind of thing.
Almost green, like, kind screen.
Like kind of teleprinter style sounds coming out of everything, you know?
This is true, but if you were building a spacecraft now, would you? I mean, unless you're Elon Musk and you just decide that that's how you're going to do it, I just don't think that's probably how they put, not least because those screens are an incredibly heavy thing to launch into space.
But you look at things like Blade Runner, from that aspect, Ed, where it did have a lot of CRT technology and all this, but it also got a lot of things.
No, Blade Runner. Bang on. Another one that looks, actually, I have to say, the more you watch it, you think, they could be on something here, is Fifth Element. A lot of how that's done is, you know, I think that holds up and looks pretty cool.
In what way? The New York? Or?
That and the airport, come spaceport, you know, where they're sort of flamethrowering alien life out of the other. I sort of, that just strikes me as, you know, 23rd century baggage handlers. That seems all very, very, very sort of conceivable as a concept.
I mean, there's another film which, it was good fun and all the rest of it, but really, you love it or hate it.
I think that's the nature with anything that's stylized. That's not too surprising. I mean, in the same way that whilst I freely acknowledge it is absolute bobbins as a film, as a visual thing, I have long loved Toys, the Robin Williams LL Cool J thing, just because it looks like nothing else. You know, the rest, I freely acknowledge the film itself is bobbins, but in some ways it doesn't matter.
Okay, so winding this all the way back to the original thing, you know, was there any fun Star Wars? Was there any parodies? I can only think of one, which was obviously Spaceballs, which was completely unfunny.
There was one called Hardware Wars, by the same guy that did, and Ned might know this, because he also did Pork Lips Now. I don't know if you've seen Pork Lips Now.
I don't know who, I'll have to look on Tinternet.
Pork Lips Now was a piss take of Pork Lips Now, and Hardware Wars is obviously a piss take of Star Wars, done with, you know, irons and that sort of stuff, and spaceships. But it was quite funny.
And then obviously, I always never forget the end of History of the World Part 1 with Jews in Space, which is probably insensitive, except it's Mel Brooks. So I think all bets are off as to what constitutes.
Well, that means it's completely unfunny then if it's Mel Brooks.
Ooh. Burn.
What was the one with Mel Smith and Griffith Jones? Was that?
Oh, God, yeah. And they're towing a spaceship through space with a shank.
It was shockingly bad, I remember. Morons from Outer Space.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Terrible. I'm not sure it was a Star Wars parody. I mean, a parody as such, but it was...
Okay, so getting back to the original question here, which was Guardians of the Galaxy. It was the first film which really sort of got that fun element of Star Wars. And thinking about it and going through our recollections of our childhoods and other films, sci-fi films over the years, I don't think anybody has managed to capture that apart from Marvel. Would we agree on that one?
I think it's been done with... I do think Guardians of the Galaxy does it pretty damn well. But it's just the nature thing. I think obviously the indelible effect that Star Wars has on these things just sort of gives it a head start in this regard.
I don't think there's anything that's kind of directly analogous to Star Wars. I think, you know, all of the films from that era tended to skew towards sci-fi rather than space fantasy, inevitably being more kind of space-based. And I think Guardians of the Galaxy even is more of a kind of comedic romp than anything else. You know, I just don't think anyone's quite got that mix. And perhaps that's why, you know, people still love it so much.
And it's a strange thing because, you know, we're going to come on to this, Steve, because, you know, we sat down and where I came up with this question. You said you've been speaking to your mate about it and all the rest of it. You know, the first thought you have is, oh yeah, around about the 70s and 80s, I remember loads of sci-fi, but none of it was actually the same as Star Wars. It came about because of Star Wars and because of the box office that Star Wars made, but none of it could really compete.
No, I don't think so. And I think also people discovered, because you watch Star Wars and think, okay, yeah, that's straightforward. He's taken some very, you know, basic tropes and mixed them together, and then you've got the hero and the villain and spaceships, and how hard can that be? But actually, Lucas distilled lightning in a bottle with that film in a way that no one had before or since, and copying it wasn't as easy as people thought it was going to be. Because, you know, you've got to have, and that's why it's so rare for them. I think Guardians works because it has a likable cast, because it has interesting characters, because it has great effects and a fun story, and it is a good fun romp. I think for the same reasons Firefly and Serenity worked, because they did a similar thing. They had likable characters and good actors playing them and a fun plot. But actually, if you look at the Star Wars knockoffs and even films that were influenced by Star Wars, they're rarely as good, if ever, because Star Wars is unique.
I mean, there are certain weird things that I think have an effect on our... Essentially, whenever you try and be in any way faithful and sort of accurate in terms of how things move from space, the joy goes. Because it was funny. Do you remember right at the start when they rebooted Battlestar Galactica? And they actually, because they did that, what's the phrase? Inertial based. So just because you turned something round didn't stop it moving in the direction it had previously been proceeding in, because there's no resistance. And people went, oh, that looks really weird. But technically that's right. But it's never going to be as exciting looking as what basically is a World War One, you know, World War One rules of aerodynamic movement in space.
Although I've got to say that they did get the Viper stuff really.
I thought it looked really, really good. Cool, but it did look quite. It looked totally different to anything that had sort of really gone before in that.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't help. I mean, obviously, in terms of when it comes down to that, Star Trek is sort of hopelessly joyless, because you sit there, you know, when they're in the middle of a full on, you know, orgy of destruction, you just sat there at a sort of, you know, typewriter style terminal pressing buttons, and it all sort of moves around gently and occasionally throws a bit of sparks.
I mean, it's funny you say that, and I'm sure I'm positive we did discuss this a few podcasts back, maybe a few months ago now, but you know, with the Star Trek series becoming available on Netflix again, and I started watching Next Generation, and I watched that religiously when it was originally broadcast, and I loved it, and I watch it now, and it is just so full of obvious messages that the writers wanted to get across. And there's a great documentary on Netflix at the minute all about Gene Roddenberry and just what an awful guy he actually was to work for and all the rest of it. I mean, it's a really insightful documentary. Go and watch it if you're into sci-fi and Star Trek and that kind of thing, because it opens up a lot of things that have never been covered about Gene Roddenberry, but it that series, like you say, there was no action in it. It was people standing at consoles. It was people being intelligent and intellectual and talking about things. And there was all these supposedly hidden messages that stand out like a sore thumb now. And to me, it's almost unwatchable.
I mean, this is the thing. It sort of works on the principle that, okay, mankind has moved past the need for, you know, capitalism, so on and so forth. That's all by the by. But if you're telling me that humanity and the other alien species had moved beyond the point where, given 500,000 tons of state-of-the-art ships, someone didn't go, just what happens if we turn it up to 11? I don't think we've evolved beyond that point, if I'm honest. For as long as humanity has existed, it's like, well, we've got this. How fast will it go? I don't think we could have eliminated that from society, if I'm honest. But
yeah, and the holodeck, you just know that there's programs in there called Bunny Club.
you just know that wiping that down at the end of any given session is the worst job in space.
The cleaner on the holodeck.
That's the nature of it. Joy in space. Dear Hollywood, more joy in space, please.
I've actually thought of a last-minute addition to our list of films influenced by Star Wars. Battle Beyond the Stars.
Oh, I'd, yeah, totally.
Isn't that just The Magnificent Seven in space?
It's a remake of The Magnificent Seven in space that even has Robert Vaughn playing the same character he played in The Magnificent Seven. But come on, it's a good laugh, and I'd it's got George Peppard in it.
Yeah, but it also has John Boy Walton.
Yeah, but it also has Sybil Danning in it. So that's good enough reason to say you go and see it.
And it has that transferable soundtrack that all those sci-fi films had at that period in time.
The score was done by James Horner, and the effects were done by James Cameron. So,
well, there you go.
I will say, if you watch Spaceballs, if you look at Rick Moranis' helmet, it's almost the spitting image of Diane Abbott's haircut.
Okay,
thank you for that quote for the week, Mark.
And on that bombshell, that's it for the EV Forums podcast this week. My thanks to Steve Withers.
What should we do next? Something good, something bad, bit of both?
Mark Hodgkinson.
See, this is exactly why none of you have any friends.
Ed Selly.
I'm going to die surrounded by the biggest idiots in the galaxy.
And Mark Borre.
It's not a purse, it's a knapsack.
I'm not sure if those were quotes for the film or not. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark AV Forums for latest reviews, news and videos, and of course, leave us those 5-star ratings on iTunes, but only if you enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.